going to be very difficult. We are operating sitting here, and you're currently sitting there. And just now, the operator wants to speak. He's going to ambush.
Further comment. There were again an exhaustive round of consultation to the industry, because the time when people are providing us with submissions and votes, there were meetings with the industry, and that resulted in a further revision. We had to use dual rates, the CIPA will deal with those, for defined and undefined resources. And we changed the approach after hearing the industry, and we then published a third version on the 6th December 2007. And that's the version that we are now coming to discuss in Parliament. As with all such bills, we've also asked for further comment, and the closing date is end of February, so we kind of, we just got them all come in. But yeah, that's the background, and I think Keith, you can tell us the second slide, which I really doubt that we can skip to the slide 5. But I'll ask this one to go into the detail, because he is the expert now, and I think it's the title of the second one to get it through.
Thank you. On slide 5, there's an important provision within the FDRPA. I think members have dealt with this particularly important provision. As Lois mentioned, historically, there has been some communities and even private individuals that have received what has been referred to as consideration or royalty payments from mines. And an important provider in the MDRPA, which is Item 11 of Schedule 2, protects that mineral royalty that these communities receive. And that is something which we don't touch on at all in the royalty bill. There are certain conditions that communities need to meet to, in order to continue to receive this, and it is expanded in the rest of the item. I've just highlighted the first two points that relate to the item. Slide 6. I just got a few extracts from various sources, but this particular issue of community royalty is not unique to South Africa, and there is a quote from the experience in the Canadian case of community royalty being imposed, and in some instances in addition to the state royalty. Slide 7, again just providing some broad background on why mineral royalty. And as Momo mentioned, the mineral royalty is a payment for the owner of a mineral resource, and with its new MPRPA state is now Australian law tax. And that is in addition to the state's right to impose normal tax. So the royalty on mineral resources is in addition to its normal form of tax. Slide 8, just expand on that again. It's a payment for the extraction of the non-renewable resource, and that's an important point, that once this resource is mined over time, this resource becomes exhausted, and in lieu of that, the state earns some income, which some people call it rent. The slide 9 and 10 just elaborate further on the principle of the imposition of a royalty. The important point here, that this is an debate that has been extensively covered in literature. There is a concern from some people that say that if you impose a royalty, you will sterilize some of the resources. The counter argument there is that the point is that you are extracting an exhaustible resource, and therefore that payment is likely due to the owner of it. Slide 10 starts to discuss on what we should base the royalty. And here, history suggested quite a lot of experiments. And one example is where people impose a royalty on the production, so the ore that you extract is related to a cent or a rand for ore. In other instances, it's the value of the commodity for gross sales. In other instances, it was property. So possible places on which you can follow the royal team. The other important aspect of the royal regime or any text is the rate at which you follow. So you have to first quantify what's the text phrase, and then once you appear on the text phrase, you have to determine a rate. Many countries have a flat rate or a fixed rate, and then the fixed rate then differs sometimes from mineral to mineral, and we'll get to a few examples. And in some instances, a progressive rate is imposed. The important point with any text is that you should be able to try and design in such a way that you can administer it. And so it's not only the principle of taxation is important, but also ability to administer it, and therefore one should always take cognizance of the difficulty with administration. Slide 11. Again, I'm spending a bit of time here, but it's important that we understand the long debate we had in this particular area about what should be the text plan. Just to repeat here that you've got these options of using value or sales, the option of physical quantity or the action of profitability. And in most jurisdictions, the value of the commodity or the total sales is being used in the bank. On slide 12, many jurisdictions have actually gone one step further and take cognizance of the fact that in some instances, some processing takes place before the commodity is installed. And therefore, certain deductions are taken into account. And the term that has been used sometimes is the term of net gross return, which is to take the gross sales value, you deduct certain expenses, and derive the revised rate. And the purpose of this is to take cognizance, as I said, of other costs that happen after the extraction. And there are two prime types of costs that are taken into account here. One is transportation cost, because depending on where the mine is located, different mine might have different transport costs, and therefore you want to try and utilize for the location of this advantage that some mines might have. And the other one is refining and smelting, which is the process of beneficiation, which you don't want to discourage, and therefore you try not to take the value added in that process. Slide 13, again, takes a tri-comparative aspect of what the royalty rate should be, and here there was a lot of debate. And in one document which I quote quite a bit in this slide, argued that the rate in the order of 3 or 4% seems to be a reasonable rate that has been imposed across many countries. There are one or two exceptions, and precious stones and diamonds there have been noted as being exceptions. On slide 14, just to give you a bit of a background about the text base in the second bill took cognizance of some of the concerns that were raised about the broad base that was implied in the first bill, which was gross sales, and here we have to make further and have a scheme price. Already in the second bill, certain deductions were allowed. So we started with gross sales and we allowed certain deductions and then a few additions just to make sure that, there are no avoidance. So transport costs were already allowed for in the second bill. Slide 15 takes that principle concept further and saying these are some of the expenses. If we do want to look at the revised text base, then those are the type of costs that you should take note of. Transportation for handling for smelting costs and refining. At that point, Mr. Chair, we consulted and tried to get from the industry the type of expenses, if we were to go this route, what are the types of expenses that we should consider? And in slide 16, there is a list of expenses that we managed to obtain, and these are the ones that is currently in the bill and will be expensed in terms of it differs from mineral to mineral. But you can broadly see that 0.1 to 0.7 are expenses related to activities that could be described as beneficiation. Those are the types of expenses that we would classify as post-extraction expenses that we have identified that could be deducted from the base. And the 0.8 to 11 are all related to one or other form of transportation. Again, different minerals with different words, we just need to make sure that it is. So those are the broad categories of expenses we think ought to be allowed as deductions in order to try and have a equitable tax item. Based on information that we received, we managed to identify 9 key minerals in the country, which we got information from. There's a couple of others which we didn't get information. And we wanted to have a feel of what are the extent of the deductions. If we're going to allow the deductions, how far are we going to allow the tax base? Because we must be very careful that we don't allow the tax base completely. And we got this information. If you look at the table, which is added B, which is the one that we will work on. If you expect the total deductions as a percentage of the gross sales, those are the percentages. And if you look at the literature, these percentages are more than less in line. It makes sense. They say, for precious metals, the additional expenses that you incur after extraction are less, because the minerals are more or less pure minerals. The other minerals, if you go from manganese onwards, the expenses that you can potentially allow for are slightly higher, and the cost debt is largely transport related. So that's the reason why you've got those potential differences. And these are some of the figures that we think we should use as some benchmark figures if we go in this direction. So we talked about the base and the potential adjusted base. The royalty rate. In the second world, where there was concern about the fact that you had a flat rate and a differential rate for different royalties, that people say, why do you discriminate against certain minerals? There was an attempt to accommodate the idea of having a lower rate for beneficiated products. If you go to slide 19, you will see there are the so-called dual rate structures, one for refined products and one for unrefined products. However, having tried to analyze this and tried to define what is refined and unrefined, we ran into a few problems, specifically on iron ore, for example. The way the second world was drafted, it implicitly taxed steel, for example, as a refined product, and that was never the intent. So we said, do we have a different way of dealing with this? And then we exhaustively discussed the slightly revised tax base. We said, let's try and see if we can't use a slightly revised tax rate structure. Let's link it to slide 20. We said, instead of trying to identify specific rates for specific minerals, and you render it for saying why you have a higher rate for this mineral and a lower rate for that mineral, we said, let's try and use a formula-based royalty structure. And the formula that we propose is that, where Y is the royalty rate, A is the minimum rate, X is a variable which is defined as EBITDA over gross sales, which is a measure of profitability, and B is the constant factor that you adjust to arrive at a reasonable rate structure. The important question that you have to ask here is, what's the typical value for X in this particular formula? Because that is the key determinant in trying to use this particular form. On slide 21, we managed to get some information that says, on average for the past 4 years, between 2003 and 2006, these were the EBITDA of the gross sales percentage. Now, obviously, it differs significantly from mine to mine or from mineral to mineral, but it gives you a feel of the quantum of the numbers. That then led us to try and structure a formula that makes reasonable things. And if I bring two, give you three to dollar.
Unfortunately, the other is a bit small, but if you've got the
slide with you, you'll see in the first column, we calculate the ratio of EBITDA over gross sales, or measure profitability. And if you look at the previous slide, that is ranging between 25 and 40. So if you look at between 25 and 40 is your range, you've got three options. You've got option one, where you've got a minimum rate of 0.5% and a lead factor of 12.5. And option two, where you've got a minimum rate that goes all the way to zero, with a factor of 12.5. And option three, with a minimum rate of 5 and a lead factor of 15. In the build, we have opted for option two. And you'll see, if you look at the third column, which is option two, the typical royalty rate would range from around about 1% to in the order of just under 4%. That would be the range of the royalty structure on average between 1 and 4%. The next slide just shows you graphically how these rates will vary depending on the EBITDA of the gross sales. And the big graph is the same as the three options earlier on. It can either go from 0.5 up to around about theoretically in the order of 0.8 if you've got 100, but obviously it will never get to 100. The important one is to look at not the green one, the orange one and the blue one. And you'll see the blue one goes to a minimum of 5, the intersect around about at a beta of 40, and then they go slightly different. And the logic here is that, depending on which one you go, is that you provide relief at the bottom end, and go as low as zero in option two, but you make up for it in the case where the profitability tends to be quite high, and you can come then to that particular one. So that forms the basis of a comparative between the various options. Slide 24, Chair, discuss some of the advantages of this formula, and one can also talk about your disadvantage. The derived rates are related to the ability to pay. That's important principle that you make. You don't discriminate against different minerals, because it becomes very difficult, and you don't have to adjust the rate when things are bad or when things are good, because there's an automatic adjustment in the rate. You also don't have the problem of identifying what is a marginal mine, because the rate structure automatically takes for marginal mine. And this is, one, to me, one of the important advantages of this. In the mining industry, obviously, the profitability of any company depends on who the company is managed, but commodity prices play a key role in determining the profitability of a mine, and therefore, variation in commodity prices is critical, and sometimes, to a large extent, commodity price variation, most commodities are outside of the hands of the producer, and the inspection process. And then, government share in both the upside, in providing relief at the bottom end, and to also get benefits when commodity prices are high. The one concern that one should raise is the definition of beta and make sure that there is no manipulation thereof. People also say, yes, but you reward inefficiency when you penalize efficient mines. But to the extent that the profitability of the mine is largely related to the commodity prices, one would probably hope that that would not be a major. Okay, those are, I think, some of the benefits of a new regime that we've identified. And this then goes to the specifics of the bill. Slide 26 just gives you a little bit of a history of the tax base from the first draft to the third draft, and I did explain it, and I'm not going to go into details of that again. Slide 27 create the basis for us having an adjusted tax base. And then slide 28 defines what we mean by EBITDA, which is a concept I think generally used these days, although probably not as defined as clearly as some of the other concepts, but we think it's a concept that we can live with, and it's a measure of profitability. Then to go into some of the specifics of the bill, slide 29, there is various definitions. The right to apply to the geographical areas within the confines of the mineral resource rights. So you have clearly defined and very much linked to the MPRDA. The royalty only applies to the extractor, the person that recovers the minerals, and it includes minerals and petroleum. The slide 30 talks about charging provision. The royalty rate is imposed on the extractor. The royalty payment is equal to the rate times the base. The cycle of assessment we have proposed on a 6-month basis, and the revenue is paid into the national revenue fund. Slide 31, in section 3 of the bill, we define the royalty rate. It's slightly refined version of the formula, but it's basically the same. It's EBITDA over gross sales divided by 1.25 in a revenue percentage. As I mentioned, Mr. Chair, the rate fluctuates in line with the measure of profitability, and there again is EBITDA. Slide 32 is information that gives us an indication of how the ratio of EBITDA of the gross sales fluctuated for the various minerals over the past 5 years, between 2000 and 2006. And then we also calculate the average for these various minerals. Slide 33 provides a comparison. In this slide, I just showed you every move from the first graph, what were the proposed rates, and they were specific rates different by mineral type. In the second graph, we moved to a so-called refined and unrefined rate for some minerals. In the case of diamonds, there were only one rate, there was no dual rate. For the other minerals, there were dual rates. And then I calculated just a theoretical average for those two rates. And then I calculated, based on the previous slide information of the EBITDA over the past 5 years using the average, if I plug that average into the formula and use the three options, you will get that rate there. Now obviously it will differ from year to year, the rate number 6, but for comparative purposes, we took an average. And you can see there has been quite significant difference between the rate in the first graph, the second graph, and the option that we've done. For example, diamonds on average for the past 5 years have been taxed at the rate of 3.7 instead of the 8.5. For some of the other minerals it might be higher, like for example manganese, there was an average of 3 in the second bill, and it will be 3.3 under the option 2. And so we can go through each one of them. The important aspect of the base is the before expense on what aggregate growth sales is. Here, again, an important provision in the revised bill is that we now tax a mining company as a whole. And that's an important change. Because you don't have to look at per mine or specific mining area. A company now can aggregate the sales of all its mines, and based on that information, you calculate your liability. It also overcomes the problem where some mines, for example, might be producing predominantly platinum, but they might produce also gold as a byproduct, and you have different rates. And there might be mines that produce one or more than one type of mineral. this case, it doesn't really matter because you lost it all together and you work out an average. Slide 35, and I'm going to try and rush through this. As I mentioned earlier on, there are deductions that you propose that will be allowed to subsidize and then buy and pay. Slide 36, just expand on that. Slide 36 also indicates clearly what expenses will not be allowed as a deduction of indirect expenses. It's only direct expenses with related to transportation or beneficiation in the will be used as the process that will be allowed. And I think we will expand on this later on in the regulations to make it clear where there is a significant difference between the various types of money. Keith, do you want to talk to slide 37?
I thought when you said I was going to come to Rome to let him know, but it's that balance. Okay, go ahead.
There's certain worries that we have in this bill that we've been trying to adjust accordingly. And that is, what we're worried about is oftentimes a related party sale. If you worry about that income tax, you should worry about a little bit more in the royalty bill for a very simple reason. The income tax, most people are subject to tax, but with a few exceptions. In the world of royalty, there are only a few people who are subject to tax, and most of the world is full of exemptions. Remember, we'll only tax can be extracted and nothing more. So you have to worry about transfer pricing, especially with the groups and other things like that. And so we took a number of attempts to try and deal with that with a number of anti-avoidance rules. The problem with some of the early anti-avoidance rules is we were trying to objectively come up with a price without really relying on arm's-length pricing. We were doing that based on some formulas of things in order to protect citizens. But the problem is every time you try to substitute for chance pricing, there's just no substitute for chance pricing. So, you know, it's one of those things that the bill has to take into account. So a number of the rules, what we did is we took some of those out and we simplified the basic premise there. But what we're really trying to do in this bill is try to prevent people from maneuvering their activities in order to get around the royalty. So one of the things that we worry about here, we said, okay, we're going to set transfer pricing, we plan to get the transfer pricing, we will just provide that kind of pricing rule, and it will have to be subjected to the market. The other one that we're worried about is that people could play games as to when they dispose of royalty. So, for example, let us say I just take it out of the ground and I sell it. Well, you haven't had any value on it. You haven't even done anything. But you're selling it before you normally would sell it because you know the price is going to be lower. So for a very simple example, you take it out of the ground and it's worth 100. Normally you do a little bit of cost. You clean it a little bit, whatever, maybe it's 130, but then you sell it. But if you sold it at the 130 stage, you're going to have a higher royalty. So what you do is create an artificial company and sell it when it comes out of the ground. So what we basically did is put the gene rules in to say, you're going to be deemed to have sold it at the point when you would normally sell it for commercial purposes. You can't start manipulating the tax fees. So what happens is you can't accelerate your sales date in order to drop your value more efficiently. That's the new key when that comes into play. There's also a second one. If you export the minerals, you don't sell. For instance, you just transport it to the headquarters back home. We also deem you to have a sale there, because once the minerals have left the country, we don't deem you to sell after. We don't deem you to sell at the export point where you're in serious trouble. Then there is also another third rule, which is a little more complicated, but sometimes what will happen is, and this goes back to the first two rules connected. You take the minerals out of the ground, you see it a little later, it's a little later slide. You take it out of the ground, and I've spent so much time with the minerals. You then do a fair amount of processing, which is cleaning. Then you do some serious beneficiation. Then what you do is manufacture. What we're trying to do is say, when you pull it out of the ground and you do your basic processing, that is the sale point. completely manufactured. You're doing something else. The example that we think of most is steel. So you take your metal and you're getting ready to go into steel, and before you reach the steel point, it's worth, say, 300. But now you're going to manufacture steel with the minerals, and now it's saying by the time the manufacturing is done, 800. Well, we want you to stop right before the manufacturing starts, because the royalty should never apply to manufacturing. So we create a deed of sale right before the manufacturing in order not to impose additional tax on that value. So really, the key thing is that we impose deed of sale at the proper point that you would normally sell a mineral without manufacturing that type of mineral. So once you reach manufacturing, you should be charged there. But anyway, that's a little quick explanation, but Nancy avoided the thing. I have a feeling we will come back to that.
Like, did I just deal with some of the normal rules that are provided in other tax legislation, also in that legislation, in the case of bad debt, when you paid it, and there was no, when you sold something, didn't receive payment, they actually then have to revert that legislation, because at that stage, the commodity had not been sold, so you have to get a refund, and then pay the royalty the next time you get it again. So the conversion is just that when you sell in foreign currency, it's the day from which you have the conversion to spot rate when the money is received or actually then on 39 and 40, we provide some relief measures, and specifically in slide 39, we provide relief measures for small miners, and we define small miners in mine with a turnover of less than 5 million rand, with a royalty liability not exceeding 50,000. They expect they must be an African resident and must be registered with a commissioner, so an illegal small miner will not qualify for relief. He will only qualify for relief if he can pay this thing. If he is caught out, he can't claim relief. And also, there are entity avoidance measures built into this so that you can't split your mine into smaller units in order to qualify for this type of relief. In some instances, mines do export samples for further processing or investigation, and in those instances, we will allow mines to take the mineral out without any royalty being imposed, provided it will come back. In order to allow this not to be used, we put the monetary limit to this provision. And in slide 41 and 42, you will end to avoid it. You probably get to talk to them again.
And that is back to the arm's length of the unit. And as you said, a lot of times, that's really what we're getting at. Basically, what we've done here is that we're giving a broader arm's length of pricing power than we have to. The income tax, you only have the power to impose arm's length pricing at cross-border transactions between related parties. So it's fairly narrow, the income tax. So there's some changing rules that are sort of taking back here, but in general matter, at least in terms of facing the act, arm's length pricing is sort of thing, because foreign is the only way to outside the system. As I said, in the royalty bill, most people are outside the system, and they're only a few extractors. Anybody can deal with it, but they'll want to do shit with it. trying to get a fair and reasonable price without regard to the whale. But you do take into account their individual circumstances. So the bottom line is you just want to make sure that people are doing pricing without regard to the tax system, i.e. the whale system in this case. Again, a lot of this comes down to facts and circumstances, and the issue will be having good evaluators in order to make sure. And then the other one here is the general anti-avoidance rule. Here, again, with most of our acts, except for one or two, which is sort of anomalies, we have a general anti-avoidance rule. Again, this act is fairly new, so we haven't seen all the avoidances yet. That will be for many years to come. And so what we have is this prophylactic measure that says, don't play games with us. If you do, we will come at you. And that would be our first line of defense. The specific objective rules will follow as we carry on. I think that's what
The next three slides, I'm not going to spend a lot of time. The point we're trying to do there is because investing in mines is a long-term investment, especially for a large investment. And there has been an argument that you should provide some fiscal guarantee for that type of investment. One example, we've done this in the petroleum industry. The proposal here is to allow investors the option to enter into a fiscal stability agreement, and the minister will subject to certain considerations be in a position to sign such an agreement. It basically means that the formula to calculate the monthly rate and the basis on which the tax base is calculated will remain in force for the duration of the royalty rights of that particular investor. That is covered in slide 43, 44, and 45. Slide 46 just briefly indicates some of the administrative aspects of the regime. They must register with the commissioner, must return within 30 days of the end of the cycle assessment period, and then certain provisions of the income tax will apply from an administrative review. The last slide I want to stop to share, the rest of the slides can take a background information which you will not see. It's just a brief estimate, and this is really a rough estimate at this stage, to say, to quantify what will be the revenue take from the phone. We've got in the second column the estimated gross sales for 9 of the minerals, of the larger minerals in the country. That's in column 2. Column 3 gives you the adjusted tax paid, which means after allowing for certain deductions, what will be the tax paid? And you can see there, for example, in the case of PGM, where the gross sales was 53.9 billion, allowing for certain deductions, reduced the tax rate to 48.9. And then applying different rates with various options. One was the fixed average rate, and then the three formula options. And you can see the estimated revenue that will be generated from that. And the option two that is included in the bill will generate in order of 3 billion rand. It would have generated 3 billion rand in 2006. As you know, the bill, the royalty regime kicked in on the 1st of May 2009 as the conversion from the old to the new water rights has been completed. That's our story.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. As you would be aware that this is a bill that touches on another portfolio committee as well. One of the processes that we will still have to get into is that of also making sure that at committee level that is also judged. We had invited the portfolio committee on minerals and energy to do it up today, but they have other committees, but it is always good to be one of this matter for the 2020 because we know that once it is it is still in line with the parallel legislation that they also have passed, that it also doesn't necessarily undermine some of the objectives. objective of the translation. But you will be proceeding with that. This is just the interpretation on our side, and I would imagine the portfolio commission is familiar with some of the issues that you raised about. I'm then going to open this questions, discussion, comments. Can I just also check my understanding here? On the media statement that you provided us with on the third draft, which is dated the 6th of December 2007, on page 3 of the document that you gave us, talking to small business relief, you indicate that small miners with a maximum turnover of 10 million rand per year will be entitled to receive a credit of up to 200,000 per year, which is 50,000 in a personal period of 6 months. And here on page, on your slide 39, you refer to getting a relief, the instructor must during an assessment period not have a turnover in excess of 5 million. Are you referring to the 6 month period? Not the other. Okay, members, Mr. Mladu? Mr. Marek, thank you so much. Go ahead, Mr. Mladu.
Chair, sorry, it's a sound thing that I'm speaking about. I'm taking you back on a number of things. I just wanted to get started from your media statement, which is page 4, starts from page 3, which says that communities and mining companies are encouraged to enter into negotiations to, where appropriate, convert the financial interests of communities into equity stakes in the operating company. I just want to establish whether you are of the opinion that the community should then convert the arrangements that they have in terms of the rights into stakes because it might contradict what you have been saying. I'm not clear, I'm not sure. How have you resolved the issue of community loyalty? Are you saying that community loyalty can continue as they are currently when, and in the process when you are giving them each other royalty? My second question is, I do not understand the key part where on the arm's length principle. You are saying currently the Income Tax Act, this applies to cross-border transactions between related parties. Now, what is the rationale of prohibiting it beyond this, in this current deal? What's the motivation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is just on the formula. If you can maybe just explain to me again that number, that 12.5 or the 15th, is that an arbitrary number? How do you get to that? I mean, what is the thing that influences to use as a specific number there? That's the first one. And then on the second issue, which is I'm looking at those that benefit from these royalties. And then the first one, on the write-off of bad debts, your slide 38, doesn't this give an avoidance to the extractor? Because, I mean, they can do business with whom they want, and if they decide they're going to write off in that bad debt, then tough luck, you don't get royalty on that. And, I mean, you might have a chain of companies involved where there might be connections, and others, this is kind of avoidance of royalty. So shouldn't there be a limit to this, or is this tough luck to me to the people who benefit from that? And then part of that, also the people that benefit from that, how are you going to deal with people that have really got land claims and right claims, especially local communities where there's not a lot of resources to appoint ensure that their rights are entrenched and looked after properly.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Chair. My third question is allied to the question that's already been asked on the formula. I want to know how specifically were the A and B parts of the formula determined. Did you decide beforehand how much money you wanted to collect and then work out what the balancing numbers would be, or was there another process that was followed? And then my second question relates to the deemed sale as part of the process before manufacturing, if that was the case. How was this amount being calculated? Thank you.
Thank you. Responses.
Try to keep this
point. If we go to slide 5, let's go to slide 5 then, please. I think it's important to note that the NDRPA, which is the principal act that regulates mineral rights in this country, provides in slide 4, we said, for the imposition of the levy, but the minister can only, our minister, the Minister of Finance, can only favor the money vote, and therefore we are in this process of levy. Item 11 of Schedule 2 of the NPRPA is a very important intervention. Here, the rights of communities are protected. And if you want to read the rest, I didn't put all of it here, but the conditions are spelled out there. And it is the Department of Mineral Energy that administers mineral rights. And I would imagine in their department have got a role to play in ensuring that particular provision is upheld. There's also a requirement from communities that they do receive royalties to provide the minister with updated information on how they spend the money. So that is where the rights of communities are protected, and we don't address it in the rights of the process. Very important also, this protection here does not impact on the royalty that we impose in the royalty. So that is the right to say. That's the argument that some might argue for double, so-called double royalty. We say, you know, there's very little in the royalty bill that we can address to protect it here, and that is it. The issue on our media statement where we talked about the rights for communities to enter into equity states, we have a long discussion with various stakeholders on this issue, and the conclusion was that it is up to the community and the mine to enter into the mine and the community to enter into that agreement, and that is protected here. How did they take that forward? It's a negotiation between them. In the case of the Royal Bank of King, for example, which is the community that has been used quite a lot, where they have significant royalties they receive from one of the mines, the agreement between the two parties there was that the Papua community will convert their royalty streams into equity. And they could do it, and it was their interest to do it, and they signed an agreement. We made some changes to the income tax to accommodate the deduction associated with the transfer, but it's quite in line with the payment for royalties are deducted. But it's not a requirement of the law. It's up to the communities themselves. Where communities refer to continue to refer the royalties as per the agreement between the mines, that's protected in this particular area, and that will continue to be the case. So I hope I've answered also the land length issue in that particular respect. On the formula, if you go to slide. So this is slide 20 and 22. Let's just go to 20 first. This is the crux of the formula. Now, the question was, how did we arrive at A and how did we arrive at B? you go to the next slide, next one, there are the three options that we have played around. The preferred option was option one. When I played around with numbers, I looked at option one as being the preferred option. The argument is that because this is a payment to the state for its resource, you should never let the rate go as low as zero. It should always be a positive rate. And that's the one argument, and you can see some of the quotes we have in there. The problem that we face is the issue of marginal mining. How far are we prepared without marginal mining? And the feeling was that because of the importance of mining industry, because of its labor intensive industry, and because of marginal mining will be in such a bad position when they are on the verge of closing down, you want to provide them with some relief. And so the argument is that in the extreme case, let's be prepared to go to zero, but this is probably the extreme. I would just also know that there are instances where beta can be negative, but we provide for that and say, if it's negative, we assume it is zero, so it never can go below zero. If you compare the rates that we had in the first bill and in the second bill, those rates fluctuated between 1 and 8 in the first bill and between 1 and 5 in the second, or 1 and 6 in the second, which should say the 1 and 5 in the second. So those were the rates that we thought are reasonable rates. And so if you play around with the factors, you'll see, and you assume a maximum EBITDA of around 50 and 60, you'll see the rate fluctuate between 1 and around 4.5. In extreme cases, it can go as high as 5.6. So it is those parameters that guide us. You also see that one slide where they talk about the rate internationally being a region of between 3 and 4. So the range of between 1 and 5, on average between 3 and 4, were the guiding parameters. And if you play around with the V factor, that's where you can arrive. If you have a higher V factor, the rates come down significantly, and then you're completely outside of the target range of between 1 and 4, 1 and 5.
Can I just add, I think that it's important just to look at the process. You had draft one where there was certain rates, which in a sense set an outcome. The industry came back, they said it was too high, and then you had the second firm, which had a lower rate. Then there were further consultations with the industry. So out of all these discussions, I mean, this rate has come out by and large even lower than the second draft, except for perhaps one or two. There are one or two where it could be slightly higher. So there's a bit of judgment call here. We didn't look at what the revenue is and therefore what these would be. We looked at the industry, we talked to them, and we arrived at what we thought was, I mean, after making a judgment call, that these would be the rates. So that's been the process.
Okay, so on average the real rate should be between 1 and 5 at most. In some cases it will go as low as 0 if the mine is really in trouble. And if the mine is really doing good, the commodity prices go through the roof, for a short time the mine might play a higher rate. Then
it's pretty good.
Well, basically the way the royalty is, the simplest one, the royalty is basically gross royalty with certain deductions for beneficiation. So just focus on the gross sale. If I sell you something worth $10 billion, and then you can't pay it, and then I write it off, or I say, well, I've only collected $2 million, the other $8 million, I'm not going to get. You can't tax the extractor for money he's not going to receive. It's just not. Okay. I mean, the point is, you've got to have some enrichment here. So the bottom line is, the extent that you don't collect the money that you're entitled to, and you write off the royalty, you write off the collection you're supposed to get, then that's what the bad debt rule is designed to get. doesn't make sense for, let's say, assume you have a 4% royalty, and let's say I sell you minerals for 50 million rand. Well, the royalty on that is 4% of 50 million, maybe 2 million rand. Sure, I can write off the 50 million, and I will save myself 2 million royalty, but I'll lose 50 million at the same time. So theoretically, it shouldn't be a problem with bad debt write-offs in that way. So that's why we give a bad debt write-off, and I'm not worried about the abuse on that side. And if you need to tax, you also have a bad debt write-off. The problem is, if you don't get money, you can be taxed. As simple as that. Now the question is whether that bad debt is real. If that bad debt is not real, and you're hiding it somewhere else, well, that means the guard and maybe the arms and credit stop you. But assuming you have a real debt, bad debt write-off, you're not getting the money, and you shouldn't be taxed accordingly. And that's the same as all of our etc. Maybe let's go back to the arm's length price, because I'm sort of rushing into one or two slides. Let me restate here. The gross sales, the royalty is based on gross sales. So it is very important that you have a real price. Now, if you and I are engaging with each other in the normal course of things, I'm going to want the best price on the extract. That's what I'm going to want. The difficulty is in arm's length pricing is you often put in players who really don't care about the price. So the first problem that you'll have is that if any large mining company has got multiple companies in, it's got multiple subsidiaries. One is some are doing beneficiation, some are doing extracting, so forth. They're all domestic. As a matter of fact, mining group can just create shell domestic companies. And because they know that only the extractor is subject to royalty, what they will try to do is the extractor will sell to a related party. And that will be a wholly controlled domestic subsidiary. That entity will be a shell. And they'll try to stuff all the value there. So the extractor will say sell for 100, and then the shell subsidiary will sell for 300, and therefore the royalty is depleted because the party subject to tax is getting subject to the 100 charge, but the additional 200 is being taken in the new company. And what happens is the royalty, as I said before, is the arm's length pricing we're putting in is across the board, not just cross-border, because in the income tax, what you worry about is the cross-border situation, because the income tax doesn't generally apply to farmers. In the case of the royalty, the royalty does not apply to anybody, domestic or foreign, who's not an extractor. So the law, the people who are outside the net are much greater, and that's why we want to apply it across the board. So that's where we're coming from. Now, we not only go after related parties, but we're also worried about friendly facilitators. Because we've learned over time that certain finance institutions will say, okay, well, you're not me, and I'm not you. Let me create a little structure for you with a small senior court, and I will basically hide your whatever you want me to do in taxes there. So the rule is a very cross-factor measure, just that any kind of side deal is going on, we will not proceed to the price. Now, the bonanza question that was asked over there, followed by that bonanza question on the first point, was that how do you know what an arm's length price is? What's a real price? So this is the difficulty that we will face, and my colleagues in Revenue Services back there, maybe they're lower down now, I'm not sure, higher up, but they will have to argue what is a price. Now what you do, hopefully, is you look on the world stage, you see the commodity price and so forth, and you determine based on those on the world stage what is the real price. But the expertise that's going to be required to do that is fairly complex. It's not an easy matter. It's not like you can just look at the London Metal Exchange and see platinum prices there. The platinum price there doesn't necessarily reflect the platinum price that comes out of the ground. But this is, in matter of fact, when you think about arm's length pricing, you see Achilles' heel in all taxes. Meaning to say in the first and second bill, you try to convene rules. The problem is anything you convene rules are ultimately wrong. So that says, hopefully, we have to be trying to get some extra fees, and we'll keep the revenue sources better with some additional funding on this now.
As you move with all the questions, I'll be sharing with you.
Thank you,
Arthur.
Further questions? If not, thank you. as I indicated, at our level, we have to engage with the portfolio commission and with the energy and establish it then where any kind of concern. Because from our side, we have an obligation to look at this side of the but as I indicated, we would have to make sure that it does not in any way undermine the objectives of the tax administration. Yeah, thank you. She's ready. We'll break the tea and then come back and take the questions on.
Follow in the revenue laws amendments later this year. So that's where we are. turning over to the next slide on the rate of threshold, this doesn't really need much of the explanation. The bottom line is that we talked about it last week, we suggested a number of key rates, corporate income tax rate being the most important. There's some side rates that go along with it. We adjusted the fuel and the excise, all according to the ministerial announcement. Then there are a number of threshold adjustments. Here, again, if you want the full list, it's in the media statement. It's also in the explanatory memorandum. I don't think there's a reason to go to the extent of the thing we've gone through last week. Turning over now to some slightly more important threshold changes and some items that are related. First, the HOMA Association. Up until now, if you were home association, sectional title, share block, and other home associations, only your levies were exempt. What we've put into the law is that there's now going to be a $50,000 exemption for investment income. Because oftentimes these associations keep cash on hand to deal with things like, you know, emergency pool repairs or security issues. And so they need to keep a bank account for a small pot of money aside just to take care of the group of people they're intending to look after. We just wanted to eliminate that administrative system. So that's that. Just to also note, there are a number from the last slide, is that there are a number of other related issues that are popping up in these homeowner associations. Won't be a subject this year, but there are issues around the VAT and the income tax about converting from one kind of association to another, making sure all of them are on par, and these issues we will be seeking comment on later in the year. Then the next slide, turn that over, on depreciation. Just also sort of related to thresholds is depreciation. One of them that, to be noted, is water pipelines for electricity. Right now, if you have pipelines for oil and gas, that is depreciable, but the water pipelines used for electrical power in a power plant are not depreciable. So what you're basically given is 5% depreciation, which is slightly more generous than accounting. Accounting ranges between 2 and 5%, so we just make sure that we give a depreciation for that. While the percentage thing is small, the pipelines we're talking about are quite large. I think we're talking about $1 billion worth of pipelines. So over 20 years, you'll be able to appreciate that, but that's a good thing for most power plants. Then there's another small one here on depreciation of small business companies. Now, we enacted a special regime for small business companies to help them out. In the case of non-manufacturing, you have a 50-30-20 rate. Well, we have certain rates which are better than that. Now, we created a small business regime to get them a better depreciation regime, but sometimes they can't get access to the ones that are used elsewhere. But the one that we're specifically thinking of is the small equipment rate. If you have small compared to 5,000, you can write it off immediately. But because of technicalities in the law, they have to get a 50-30-20 rate, even though that's less beneficial. And that wasn't our intent, so we said give them 100%. You can choose the better option, basically. Then there's just something that's related, a little bit of anti-avoidance. We have certain rules to prevent you from artificially inflating your cost for depreciation purposes. What may happen in certain situations is that you'll create an initial sale to bump up your cost to have a larger depreciation. And last, in 2007, we talked about one set of connected person rules. Another set of rules are people who are landlord tenants, where you have a sale leaseback, or a sale-sale leaseback, or a sale licenseback, and even though the ownership isn't connected, the relationship is connected. So we don't want people to artificially inflate the depreciation cost there. And what we've done is that rule is an old existing rule, but we're just trying to simplify it and streamline it the way we did some of the other rules at that time. So that's going on in that. In terms of pension tax amendments, we are trying to keep things moving along on the tax side in favor of longer-term reform and to get as much stuff done in the meantime as possible. Now, what the first bill is somewhat urgent is there are ongoing confusions in the pension area that we're trying to clean out, and there is a dual process which is a bit of a problem, and there's also other things we want to do later in the year. But what we're really trying to do is kind of simplify the overall pension tax regime. When you look at the pension tax regime, we're talking about individuals, middle class people, lower income people, sometimes very poor people. And that pension tax regime has to be as simple as possible. Unfortunately, due to whatever vagaries have occurred, we have created a very complex regime. The rules we designed are fairly good, but the problem was that they're building off of a very weak system. And really what these streamlined proposals are trying to do is bring all of those SARD practices onto the fore, which are generally designed to help taxpayers. The second issue also comes up is that you have the Pension Act and the Tax Act. And oftentimes, some of the regulations are being hidden in the Tax Act. And what we're doing is we're trying to bring all of those hidden regulations to light. Eventually, all of those rules will move over to the new Pension Funds Act once we have a reform act there and we have a streamlined process. So that's what we're generally trying to do. Turning over to the next slide on living annuities. These are important anomalies. The way it works is when you retire from your job, or if you retire from a pension fund, you are allowed to take one third out immediately, known as the one lump, it's a lump sum. And that's to use maybe to pay off your remaining house debt, hopefully, or to start that new small business, hopefully, and not to spend it on vacation. And the other two thirds is really to span over the remaining term of your retirement. Now, that spanning over the two-third remainder over your period of retirement, what happens there is there are different kinds of annuities. There is an annuity that's a guaranteed annuity, where every year you get a certain amount, no matter what you do, and then adjust for inflation sometimes. That way you know what it is. The problem with those guaranteed annuities is they often aren't investor friendly. So what happens in the world is you're allowed to have living annuities, where you're allowed to take it out over shorter periods of time, but you're also allowed to do more retirement planning with the money. Now, there's been some problems in this area, and so we, over time, administratively, tried to clean up the wasteful practices. But what has happened is that a living annuity isn't technically valid under current law, and therefore, all the pensions utilizing these things are invalid. So we're trying to clarify the law, and we did it administratively, but there was also a court case that kind of disrupted us a little bit recently, Supreme Court case. And we're trying to basically do is make sure that those living annuities are recognized so that they don't undermine the status and legitimacy of valid pension funds. That's the main purpose of that. Turning over to the next slide, preservation funds. Now, one of the things that we have to fully simplify is the kinds of funds that we have for retirement savings. Under current law, they're basically all things under the Pension Act are called a pension fund. But what you see if you read Bruce Cameron and all the other retirement stuff on Saturday morning or personal finance is there's a lot of these other ones, and they've emerged from the tax system. And what there are is there are three official types of funds, a pension fund, a provident fund, and a retirement annuity fund. Then, those who exist in law, and then there's these things called preservation funds. What a preservation fund is if you quit your job or you lose your job, you can take all of your pension and move it into this vehicle. But those aren't recognized in the official law. And what you have to do for interpretation is do a lot of strange deeming rules to get there. So what we've done is we've recognized these officially in law in order to facilitate the process and to get rid of some of the anomalies, the interpretations we're trying to overcome, and to make it simpler. And what our goal ultimately is to sort of make the ultimate option that if you retire, that automatically the money stays in the fund or goes to the preservation fund. Whereas right now, the money is automatically falling out. Now, this amendment doesn't accomplish that. This amendment begins to serve as a base so that later in the year, we can make later steps. And that's really what's happening here. A lot of what we're doing is creating a foundation for the more important reform that is coming up later in the year. But we just needed to have a proper foundation. And that's what's happening. Okay? Let's move on. Just turning on slide 12. Retirement lump sums and provisional tax. Provisional tax is designed to pick up your recurring income. So, for example, when you determine your current year of provisional tax, you look to the prior year. So what you're looking for is your recurring prior year income, your salary, or your business income, and so forth. We exclude capital gains. But one form of income we don't exclude is lump sum. So that lump sum is treated like a recurring income, and it ups your provisional tax the following year. That was never the intent, so basically lump sum are being removed from the provisional tax system. They don't distort those payments. That, you know. But I think most of those amendments overall, taxpayers agree, but I think the key stuff is later on. Okay, now we move on to more urgent matters. Now, at this stage, these are where we're going to be discussing tomorrow's hearing. Ultimately going to be about three sets of amendments. And again, they are dealing with our favorites, the corporate reorg rules and the cross-border rules. Because we know you love them and you want to hear about them. So you will have that all morning. Now, why these things are important is they might be technical, but we're talking about big money in each of these deals. And what we're driving is the first amendment set of amendments come around intra-group, the second set of amendments come around cross-border. But what we've done here is that as we wait, we lose serious amounts of money in the system. And so, having been aware of these abuses, we felt the need that we have to close these down as soon as possible. There will be some contention about that, and we'll have further discussion. But the bottom line is we do have to protect the business, and we've done this last year as well. There was a merger deal. That was a problem, and we shut that down. Now, let's just go back where we were. Turning over to this slide, if we have it. In 2006, in 2007, we stopped a few problem areas in intra-group, but we frankly didn't get the core of the problem. We stopped some of the share avoidances and some other issues on cross-border. But the main problem that we began to identify in late 2007, we were not targeting. Now, when we went to Parliament, we were aware of this, but we felt it was outside the scope of the budget. So we needed to get the minister's authority to reboot, so to speak. Now, what we did just carry over in 2007 was there were some fairly controversial discussions about the group definition. And if we narrowed the group, and we made sure that in the group definition, you would only have companies subject to worldwide tax. That was the main thing that we were going for. And in there, if you were just to give you a little bit of a rewind, being a group is a good thing. Because if you're part of a group, we allow you rollover relief. Which means that you can move assets in a group and any gain or loss is deferred. So if you narrow the group definition, the number of people who can benefit from that are fewer, in a very rough sense. What we did is we pulled out the foreigners, and specifically if you have a foreign company that owns a South African and it owns another South African, foreigners completely outside the net. There was some controversy about that. We stated in our media statement exactly what we were getting at and what the avoidance was by allowing the foreigners in. However, it turns out there are some foreign companies that are registered in South Africa that are effectively managed in South Africa that we also excluded. And we did that last year because we had administrative concerns. We felt that even though they were in substance in the net, administratively we couldn't control them in the net. And we got a fair amount of representation that said we really need to keep foreign incorporated companies in this group, even if they, as long as they are South African tax residents. And there are other issues that are not tax issues, that means that you need to allow those in order to promote foreign investment. So we gave back a little bit here and said foreign companies and SA PAC residents can remain in the group. The second issue is that we narrowed the group definition. And when we narrowed the definition, a number of people fell outside the group. And legislatively, when you fall outside of the group, you have a deemed de-grouping charge. And a lot of people complained about retroactivity and said, look, I did the transaction before, and now you're narrowing the group definition, and now you're giving me a retroactive charge. And that was what the discussion was over several months, to see if we can come to an accommodation. In the media statement, we reveal that if we go after retroactive legislation, effectively, we're going to go after the innocent and the guilty are going to go free. So what we did is we said there will be complete retroactive relief. And so the legislation can be effective immediately, originally effective a year later to accommodate. But we wanted to make sure that the degrouping charge wasn't a problem for anybody who previously did a transaction. What we get to now is, however, the key to the amendment is, well, we forgive a lot in the past, we tighten going forward. Because in the immediate state, we start to identify the real avoidance of concern. And that's where the issue is. So whatever retroactivity issues we had last year, those are just closed. I'm sorry to give a longer explanation here, but it's quite simple. Turning over to the next slide, just, you can see the slide, it's slide 15 or 15. The group structure is as follows. I think we just keep this chart out. I think it's easy to see. Still met, that's a group of companies. Parent owns 100% of sub 1. Parent owns 100% of sub 2. In a typical group transaction, sub 1 sells all its assets to buyer in exchange for a note. In the transaction, the assets have 100 value and a 20 tax cost. So basically, you have 80 gain in there. What the intergroup rules do is the 80 gain rolls over to sub 2, rollover group. And that's fine. The problem is the note that comes back, you don't have a 20 tax cost in that note. You get 100 tax cost in that note. So even though you don't recognize gain or loss, you get a full market value in that note. That full market value, that 80 additional market value in that note for tax purposes is what the problem is. You effectively get that step up. Because what happens then in the transactions that follow is people use that 100 note, or in some cases cash, in order to play games with the tax system. In essence, what those games entail is what you're trying to do is you're trying to turn rollover relief into tax exemption. What rollover relief is about is tax deferral. So if you've had gains, the gains can roll around in the group. But you're not supposed to be able to use that rollover relief to basically sell out tax free. And that's really what's at stake here. And what we're really talking about is the core of the capital gains system. The bottom line is, if you sell your shares in the open market, you will be subject to capital gains. But if a company is smart enough with a bit of lawyering and they have billions on the line, with a little bit of planning, use of that note, use of cash, and they can basically turn rollover relief into exemption. And that's what we're trying to stop in essence. That's going to be very important. Anyway, let me just skip over into where we are. Let's turn to the slide. This is on slide 18. Basically what we do, this is where the controversial part lay, is that to the extent you use a note, we're not going to give you 100 tax costs in the note. We're going to give you a rollover tax cost in the note. Only 20. So we will not allow you to bump up the note to market value because you weren't taxed at market value. And so we don't let you use the note to cash out. And we also don't allow internal cash transfers. So we narrow intergroup relief. And that's where the issue will be discussed tomorrow, that people feel that that is too harsh. Now, when we look at the transaction that's been raised, that's probably the biggest concern, and that will be a subject of discussion. discussion in the next slide. And that is, what happens here is this. The intergroup relief that we were intending to do has had a life of its own. When we enacted the relief, we were thinking one thing. But with a little bit of planning and a little bit of practice, the world emerged, and intergroup relief became something else. And what is typically being used for is in order to promote leverage buying. And the reason why it's being used, I'll let the commentators tomorrow speak more on it, is what they're trying to do is preserve the interest deduction. When you borrow money to buy a business, you want to get an interest deduction. And what they're trying to do with these structures is to make sure that they get it. And the difficulty under current law is they cannot deduct the interest on share acquisition. Now, we have reasons for that. Because shares do not produce income. So what they do is they don't want the loans tied to the shares, they want them tied to the underlying asset. So when you look at this transaction, you see various boxes. You look at the bank. What the bank is doing is it's lending money to a new co-buyer. And the new co-buyer is basically buying the assets of Target. And effectively what we're doing is the bank loan is linked to the underlying Target assets which produce income, and so the deductions are linked to income. That's essentially what they're trying to do in these transactions, and they need 45 to do it. The question before us is whether we think this thing is legitimate use of 45. Now, there are discussions that, yes, it has to be accepted for a while, and maybe we need to accommodate this. If this is important, then we might need to make these kind of accommodations. So the issue for discussion for us is how to accommodate and whether to accommodate this. And what we're hoping to do is to meet with the industry fairly soon, and hopefully tomorrow afternoon with the informal plan after the hearing, to go through the transactions, to see them in detail, so that we can separate the good from the bad. And that's really what we're trying to do. Now, that's one set of transactions. That will be the biggest discussion for tomorrow. The next issue is about re-domicile. There is something that we created a way back, and what we talk about in the world of cross-border transactions is a South African parent with multinationals. Now, this is a debate that goes back to 2001. In 2001, we had a lot of discussion about worldwide taxation. Jim Lodo, I think, remembers. We had some good times back then. And I'm not sure who else was on this, but they can join in. I begin to sense that the point is that in there, what happens is South African parent owns multinationals. And back in 2001, we wanted a fuller set of taxation of those multinationals. But the argument was, if we tax them too much, they will not be able to compete with the multinationals of the U.S. and the U.K. and Australia and so forth. So we created a compromise regime where the foreign subsidiaries would only be taxed to the extent they were high avoidance concerns or with their passive income. And we made a fairly amenable compromise to the industry. And that's what we're talking about here. But if you turn to the next slide, and the reasons why we made the accommodation is we wanted our South African headquarter companies to be competitive in foreign markets. We wanted to encourage dividend repatriation back in South Africa. We wanted greater market depth for our South African domestic operations, so our exports to increase. We also effectively wanted to increase the SA company band. The SAFI, the SAFI, these are our intellectual capital. That's what makes South Africa different than the rest of Africa. So we have these. So these things were worth preserving, and that was what the committee wanted. The difficulty we have turning over the next slide is that there are efforts being made to take out the headquarter company. So what has happened is we've given relief, we've let them grow, they move abroad, and we're all waiting for those dividends, we're all waiting for this great day to come. And then suddenly, the child has grown and says, you know, Dad, I think I want Bill Gates to be my father. I think it's time. And so just as you're about to reap our rewards and hopefully have a safe pension, they decide to move on. And what they're, this is not just a South African problem, it's an international problem. And what you're concerned about is the re-domicile of the HQ. And there are a number of ways to do that, and this triangle identifies different ways they try to get out the intellectual capital. Today, we're talking about the HQ, the charter itself, and we're also talking about foreign exchange. So turning to the next slide, what we get to is another point that gets into it, and that is, what we also created in order to help multinationals were rules to promote tax-free repatriation. So the example I have here, I have a South African HQ parent and a foreign subsidiary. We created rules to say that bringing back dividends back into the country is tax-free, because that's a good thing, for bringing things back into the country. In addition, because we gave that, there was arguments to be made that there's something called a participation exemption. That if we sell the foreign subsidiary for cash and bring it back to the HQ parent, that should also be tax-free, because a lot of the Europeans do that. So we did that. The issue that's at stake is that participation exemption. Because what has happened is, the very exemptions we are using to bring money back to the HQ parent are now being used to undermine the value of the HQ. It's now being used to distort against us. And that is the main issue that's at stake here. So turning over to the next slide, what you really have, is that what they're indirectly, the various ways to do it, the more complex structures, is the SA HQ parent. If let's say, whoever South African company wants to leave South African tax and jurisdiction, if the South African HQ parent wants to leave, under current law, we impose an exit charge. We say, you've had the benefits of South Africa all along, before you leave, you will pay tax benefits, you will pay fiscus back to those benefits. And so all of your gain will be taxed. Those rules are fine. The problem is the second set of rules dealing with the foreign subsidiary. Because they know they can't take out the HQ parent, what they do is they want to strip out all the foreign subsidiaries so that the South African multinational is no longer a multinational, it is now just a regional player. All the multinational assets in the country. That is the issue that is there. Turning over to the next slide, there are arguments that are for and con. The arguments that are raised is, well, when you break up the company, it's going to be additional South African shareholder value. And in any unbundling, that is true. But the question is the long-term benefits of South Africa. The fight is, do we care about the South African shareholder or the HQ? The issue that we believe in is the HQ. That is the essence of the issue. There are some other arguments pro and con here. I leave that for tomorrow's sake. Anyway, let me move on to these because I don't want to take too long. Let me move on to the final one on page 27. And on page 27 is the third set of tables. Now, this one is a difficult one for us because now we're talking about foreign investors in South Africa. If a foreign company or taxpayer owns South African assets and sells those assets, they are generally exempt. And that is an international rule. Foreigners can sell and they're free of capital gains. And we follow that international rule. And part of the reason is there is a shame if they just own some shares and they sell. How do we find them? But it's also enshrined in the treaty. Most treaties, and even all of our treaties, I think, pretty much enshrined in there, and that's well-established OECD practice. What has happened is they are using that exemption for foreigners and trying to multiply it and trying to spread it throughout the system. So it's not enough to get an exemption, but they want to pass that exemption throughout all of their controlled subsidiaries. And that is the essence of what's going on in there. I'm turning over to the next slide. Which is the chart, the slide greener, I guess. Slide greener, it is. What happens is you have a foreign parent with only a South African regional company. And that South African parent owns lots of lower tier South African subsidiaries. What the transactions are at stake is the foreign parent knows that it has an exemption when it sells for South African parents. However, if South African parents sell any of the sub, there's capital gains charge. Because if South African company sells South African company, there's a capital gains charge. What these deal protections we do is by setting up a new company, they sell the South African parent to the new company. Because they sold it at market value, what happens effectively is that the new co becomes exempt on the parent's gain. You've eliminated the gain. So if new co sells parent the next day, there is no tax. Then what happens is they do an unbundling. And they get all the subsidiaries up one level. So by moving all the subsidiaries up one level, they get all of the shares in those subsidiaries to enjoy that exemption, effectively. So what a number of these deals are trying to do is pass the exemption down multiple levels, so that if the foreign parent owns South African group, all of the group shares become exempt, whereas the lowly South African home-based company, all of it's taxed. So as a matter of competition, we have to make sure that doesn't happen. And it's the essence of those deals. The problem here is for us, we want to go far enough to stop the avoidance, but we don't want to discourage investment. And the question again is proper balance. And to close with all of these things, there is avoidance that are being identified. If there are legitimate uses, what we have asked the taxpayers to do is show us the legitimate uses, show us the detail, we will talk them through and see if we can strike the proper balance. But we need to strike the proper balance here, because we don't want to keep revisiting these issues again and again. Because as we do, credibility starts to wane. And if we keep trying to assist someone and keep avoiding doing things that are a problem, we begin to wonder whether any of those reliefs should be available at all. So that's my main point. So just to make a general point and then trying to take over from here, the amendments that you see following on the miscellaneous amendments is two sets of amendments. There are carryovers from 2007, and then there's small, simple, isolated amendments that are new. The point to know about the 2007 amendment is that even though we've received a lot of comments, what's happened is people have lived with the legislation for several months. And as they live with that legislation, they notice those things. And the goal here is to just get all of that debris out of the way as quickly as possible.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm going to pass back to the reorganization of the lessons. You are the reorganization of the law. Just on the foreign skilled expatriate, you recall last year we had a court case that came down that overturned SAR practice, where we said if there's an expatriate in the country, they can have tax-free accommodation for up to a year. Thereafter, it's a fringe benefit, just like a South African employee. That was overturned. We reinstated it. After some further discussion with the taxpayers and industry, we've decided that that should be extended to 2 years. That's roughly aligned with the temporary work permits that you can get. The idea here is that we're accommodating expatriates that are maintaining two homes. They've got one overseas and one locally, and so there's an additional expense for them. Obviously, as the time that you spend as an expatriate grows longer and longer, so the likelihood that you're going to be renting out your home overseas or selling it even begins to increase, and so the case for relief becomes much smaller or less compelling. But as we give in, so we take away. That's how the tax system often works. So there's a cap on the benefit that is permitted here, which is the level of 25% of the monthly salary or 25,000 a month. So if you want free palatial accommodation, well, then you're going to have to come to the party as well. On the research and development, this is a tweak to assist foreign investors, essentially. At the moment, if you fund R&D, the person who conducts the research and development doesn't get the deduction, the person who funds the R&D. That's the thinking. And normally that's how you'd like it to be. The problem comes is where the person who's doing the funding is perhaps an offshore resident that doesn't have a tax presence in South Africa, therefore the 150% deduction doesn't persist. So in that particular case, the funding party gets the benefit of the deduction, thereby creating a benefit within the South African tax system that would otherwise not be present. Reorganization.
reorganization to three. Think of it that way. It's sort of tidying up of the last amendment. We set out last year to make sure that collective investment teams could get themselves into company formation and mergers. And just to allow, there's no avoidance there, and clearly they often have formations of collective investment schemes, and they have mergers. The problem was we put in some rules to help them, and then, oddly enough, we took one or two things away, and they created some confusion. So what we've done here is kind of reinstate our original intent to make sure and make it very explicit that collective investment schemes can participate in formations and mergers. That was the first one. The second one was about services and company formation. And that is, what we did is when you do a company formation, they're generally tax-free if you're going to remain associated with that formation or that creation. And so we had one set of rules that said, okay, you have to have a 20% interest. We also had another set of rules that said, you also get exemption to do ongoing services. The problem is there was one set of formations that we missed, and that is sometimes the services aren't provided to the newly created company, they are provided to the controlled company subsidiary. So we just basically extended it to that. Then there's another issue around liquidation. Taxing liquidations and some other liquidation rules often require under current law that the liquidation get done in 6 months. And if you want more, you've got to go to the commissioner. And the reason why we put that in is we wanted to make sure it was a genuine liquidation, because sometimes people prolong their liquidation so long it's doing something else. So that's why we put the time in. However, oftentimes liquidations can become very complicated, especially when you're talking about multi-million rand deals. And so 18 months seems to be a more realistic date, and so we moved it back on taxpayer request. That's just a new amendment. And then there was also a change here of effective date. Last year, we streamlined a number of our share-for-share and our formation rules, and because taxpayers liked it so much, they wanted retroactive to January. Commonly, we do retroactivity to help some people. It causes confusion for others. And the others who were not part of that debate said, wait a minute, you've got me completely confused. I thought I was under one regime, and now I'm under another. What do I do? So these rules just make sure that you get the best of both worlds and everybody wins that. So those final criteria are there. Then there are domestic distributions. Domestic distributions here has been an odd little issue that's been around for quite some time. But basically, the typical way the law works is that if you do a dividend, you subject to state. If you do a capital distribution, you should have capital gains tax. But then there's something called a share issue, where a company has 100 shares and decides it just wants to issue more shares. So the company says that 100 shares, it ends up with 200 shares. Now the reason why you do that is to make the shares more liquid. But the company isn't really distributing any assets it owns, it's just breaking up its interest. And so we clarify in the law that does not trigger a capital gains charge. Again, I never think we never planned to, so that was just to clarify the current law. Then there was another small issue around buybacks. This is where you get lawyers and lawyers and lawyers. Basically, we put in the law that a redemption or cancellation and all of that is treated as a dividend because the company is getting it back. But the lawyers said, no, a buyback doesn't fall in a redemption because you're buying, you're not redeeming. And there's a whole set of debate. But a buyback by a company is the same as a redemption, and we just put it on cost. Then the next one is cross-redemption and cancellation. Now, you've seen this a few times before. I'm not going to go too much into it. It does require another slide. But what we see again is another series of complex rules designed to undermine the tax base. And what people are trying to do with the FTC is they're trying to undermine it by eliminating profits. And the way you do it is you create cross-holding structures. So in simple structure, parent owns stuff. What they often do is try to make sure the sub owns shares in the parent in a very weird structure. And what we're trying to do is close out the remaining deal. Now, we've been doing this for the last year and a half. We sort of picked up the deal, the son of the deal. Now I think we have the granddaughter of the deal, and the cousin of the deal. but they'll maybe come up with another version of steel. I mean, I don't know. Let's see if we've got it. They're very imaginative. Gene intergroup dividends. Let me just, without going too much into this, basically what we're trying to do is that in a group, you can move dividends around tax-free. We also have rules that deem dividends. You don't have to actually declare a dividend to which you share. You can give them a loan, or you can just give them cash and not call it a dividend. But if you do it within a group, it's free, because real dividends are free, so it should be the same as a deemed dividend. However, we had one exception that said, if you do a deemed dividend in a group, and you reduce the profits of the subsidiary, you must have a corresponding increase in the parent. If you don't have that corresponding increase, then profits are stripped out and then you have the avoidance deal. What we've done is we softened that and we said, if you have a subtraction for the subsidiary, any other connected person in the group has to have a positive, so it doesn't have to be apparent. It's a small technical issue that seems to be important to the industry. And so for every negative, there must be a positive, but the positive must be somewhere in the group. Then the last set of issues here before I turn it back to the dynamo. Most of the Diamond Levy bill, we've sat in the Diamond Levy bill now for about 6 to 8 months. What has happened is we've enacted in law, actually I think it was enacted only promulgated until just a few months ago, but we've gone through the parliamentary process last year. What we are now doing is working on the process of implementation. Once the administrative systems are up in place, the minister will make it operational. We need to make sure that DME and STARS are on board. And as we look very close at the legislation, there we've had people now picking at this fine-tooth comb as it's about to be enacted. They've found a few small issues. The main issue that was identified by STAR is some worries about short-term dining permit holders. The way the legislation works is it's a 6-monthly withholding period. But they were concerned that what about somebody who comes in the country, buys a diamond, and leaves? You're going to wait 6 months later to collect? Not a very bright move. So we've given the commission the power to say where this diamond dealer who's not really regularly engaged in this business, the commission would collect immediately upon export in order to protect the machine. The other issues that we're dealing with are transitional issues. That what's going to happen is the first 6 months of the diamond levy, there are a few small issues that have emerged which are basically cleaning us up. And then around the
right, on to the 2010 World Cup and the special tax measures associated with it. You know, a number of tweaks that are being put into the system to make sure that the legislation fully reflects the guarantees that were made to FIFA and the subsequent memorandum of understanding we reached with FIFA, and also to deal with some of the practical issues that we've run into as we started having FIFA World Cup 2010 events, 2010 World Cup events. First up is the host broadcaster, and this is now the entity that is going to be setting up the broadcast fees for the entire world. It's going to go up. Now, when the legislation was initially conceived, the idea was the host broadcaster would be based inside the tax-free bubble, and therefore would be exempt, and we would proceed on that basis. That was the common part of our understanding. But it's turned out that the host broadcaster is going to have to be in the country a lot earlier than the tax-free bubble comes through. It's got setting up to build a local headquarters, essentially, so that it can do its work in the bubbles when they come into existence. So what we're doing here is we have a certain class of entity known as the FIFA-designated service providers, which are exempt whether they're inside or outside the tax-free bubble, and we're adding the host broadcaster to that category of exempting. I should stress here, it's only exempt to the extent that deals specifically with the 2010 World Cup. So it doesn't extend to stop broadcast and other events, those are fully taxable. It's only 2010 World Cup. There's some technical changes around the concept of an affiliated entity that can qualify for some concessions here, which is broader than scope slightly there. The third bullet deals with a UIF appeal development levy. Expatriates who come in to work for FIFA and only work on FIFA are exempt on their salary income in that respect. That's part of the original legislation. But the question then comes is, what skills development levy and the UIF that goes with that. Well, it makes no sense to be exempt from the big one, but not exempt from the little tax, so we're just aligning the smaller tax group to the main exemption. The fourth bullet talks to the ability to agree a new tax-free bubble. Now, why would we want to do this? Well, it's rather interesting. This one I picked up while sitting in the audience to give a presentation at the 2010 World Cup draw. And I suddenly realized that this particular event was not covered by any of the classifications we had for a tax-free bubble, but it was quite clearly a 2010 World Cup event. And it was always intended to be an event for a tax-free bubble. So there are going to be some events which don't fit comfortably in the concept of failure or any of the other categories of a tax-free bubble. And so what's going to have to happen here is the Commission and SARS, Oxfam, and are going to have to get together and agree that those specific kinds of events fall into the framework of what a tax-free bubble should be and can be a tax-free bubble. Then, with respect to the fifth bullet, this is withholding taxes. There is a general exception for withholding taxes, which is ensuring that it works as intended. With respect to commercial entities that are part of the FIFA event. And then finally, as is the case with FIFA and UIF skills development levy payments, so it is with the entities. It makes no sense to say that an employer has to register and deduct, or has the obligation to deduct something for which the employee is not liable. So it's a technical cleanup that we're making here to ensure that the employer and the employee tax incomes are aligned. Because you'll remember the employee tax is there. To act as a holding tax for what the employee is supposed to stand over, and the employee is exempt for why is there an obligation on the employer. Then on to the next slide, which is the cross-border measures, which is actually the proper one to keep as well. But inward lending, at the moment, you can get an exemption for a dividend you receive from a South African listed company, even if it's a foreign company. Okay. Qualification item is that at least 10% of the shareholding is in South African shareholding. We're dropping that 10% threshold. So as long as you're listed in the JV, dividends from that company will be exempt as a domestic dividend exemption. Then a technical cleanup again. You've heard about the participation exemption, which encourages the repatriation of dividends back to South Africa. So the technical question is the question of whether this extends to operators offshore, which maybe it does, and so we're ensuring that the legislation covers that. Intra-CFT debt forgiveness, because we're dealing with something that is analogous to a group, we do not tax certain intra-CFT transactions. Okay, so dealing with debt, and what we're saying here is just as we do not tax various other debt transactions that occur between the CFDs, so we're not going to tax debt cancellations. And then finally, something that gave rise to a great deal of head scratching as to how to get this one precisely right. What happens when your shareholding in CFD changes from the CGT that is triggered? You don't want to get a duplicating set of CGT events. Technically achieving that was something of a challenge, but we hope we've got it right now, and I'm sure if we haven't, someone will tell us if we've got it wrong the one way, but if we've got it wrong the way that is too generous, well, I hope there's some people out there who will point that out as well. Next slide deals with public benefit organisations. Essentially, you're all aware that there's something called Section 18A deduction. And that is if you make a donation to a public benefit organization that conducts certain kinds of public benefit activities, you get a receipt for it, and then you can put in your tax return and claim that donation as a tax deduction, and you'll pay the tax, and you may get a refund. Now, that all happens when you're exempt. But what happens if your employer decides that what they'd like to do is offer you the option of having a deduction against your salary towards a inclination to what is public and what is public. And there are some progressive employers that you can start to check if you would like to give a donation to this particular public benefit organization. They'll deduct it from your salary and pay it over on your behalf. Some of them will give you a matching donation. So we read, you put in the output in that. Again, you have to wait until the end of the year to get the benefit of this. So what we're envisaging here is to actually give the employer's discretion, because we do accept that they may be financial administrative worker for the employer. The employer can elect into a system where they will take those monthly deductions into account for working out your pay to work. You will then get immediate benefits for what you've done. There's some technical aspects that we need to work through on this one with the players in the public benefit organization arena. For example, there's a question as to whether we should allow the full 10% here or perhaps a lower amount, just in case there are other deductions that will come through on assessment. And there are questions of how we're going to make sure that there's a proper audit track to ensure the right quality of the deduction. Next up on the public benefit organization, the risk of a small tweak. If you liquidate the PBO, the liquidation proceeds need to go to a similar PBO. What we say here is sometimes it's very difficult to find a similar PBO. What is exactly similar to what you were doing? Perhaps you were the only PBO in the country doing this. So you can now pass it on to any other approved PBO, which should give it a more flexibility. Right, some administrative changes. First up is the site system. Now, the site system works on what's called an annual equivalent. So if you work for 3 months, it assumes you're going to work for the full year. And let's assume you earn 10,000 rand a month for those 3 months. For the next 9 months, you didn't have any employment whatsoever. The site system taxes you as if you were earning a salary of 103,000. Okay. Now, that's an interesting example. So the first 60,000 is taxed under the site system, and the next 60,000 under the paid earn system. So don't worry about that for the moment. The concept there is that the site system is essentially annualized your salary. A better example would be you earn 60,000 over the year, so 5,000 rand a month. So you're purely in the site system. So that's a better example. You've got 15,000 rand, you've actually paid tax on it, but you're way below the tax threshold. So you should not actually have tax. Right? At the moment, the site system simply says, pay the tax. What we're saying going into the future is that you will be able to lodge a return and get a refund of the tax that you were paying. So that is something that should be very welcome to employees who find themselves in that situation. The next one on that particular slide deals with the employee tax liability. At the moment, SARS takes your IP5 and gives you a credit for your pay to earn, and may make a refund on the basis of that pay to earn right there. Whether or not the employer has in fact paid that over will properly reconcile that you were the person who in fact paid that amount. So the audit trail here is problematic. The employer may not have provided any documents to show that you were the person who paid that. And you can see that the risk that exists for SARS here, are we giving the right person the credit? Was the credit a valid credit in the first place at all? So what we're suggesting here is that unless the employer has submitted a reconciliation to SARS, that we can track that the payments are going to the right person, the payments were in fact made, we're not going to get the credit for the employee's tax. On the next slide, we will talk about administrative penalties. Especially at the moment, there are a number of administrative penalties that exist. What we're hoping to do here, and this is going to be an incremental approach, is we're starting with some of the penalties at the lower end of the scale. We're going to try and make them more consistent. We're going to prepare a set of regulations that will give guidance as to under what circumstances the administrative penalty should be imposed, what kind of aggravating factors may exist to increase the penalty, what kind of mitigating factors that might exist to reduce it. We believe that will give us greater more certainty to taxpayers. If this particular approach works, then we can look at extending it to some of the other penalties in the system, As everybody knows, we've shifted to a system of e-filing that has become a lot more popular than it's ever been before. As part of that shift, we were no longer required to attach certain documents to the return because it's now an electronic return. And even if it's a paper return, we're not looking for those documents. You need to keep them, and if we need them, we'll call for them. Here's a little case where the administration moved a little faster than the legislation, because there are cases where the legislation, in fact, asks you to attach a document. So that is causing some difficulty. So what we're suggesting here is that we didn't need that requirement. Essentially, so you just have to have that documentation available in SARS also. And you'll see that there are several provisions in the legislation that sort of have hard-coded that into the law. We say, well, let's take it up because it doesn't fit the new model for attachment. Right. The second bullet here is an interesting one. There has been an obligation on employers to provide an annual reconciliation of employee tax within 60 days of the end of personal finance tax year for decades. Interestingly enough, because there isn't a penalty in respect to this, it is an obligation that an employer has to neglect. And so we find ourselves in a situation where late last year we still had employers who had not prepared this reconciliation. And again, this is a serious problem for the filing system, because if we're not getting the documents from the employers, how can we check what's being put in the return? Because remember, we're not asking for the R5 anymore, against what the employer gets. Okay, because the employer doesn't get anything. So the cost check will inevitably fail, and we're going to start denying refunds to taxpayers because we can't do a cost check. People's returns are not going to be assessed because we can't do a cost check. And if we were to do the assessment and we were to make the refund, we would be doing it on pure faith without being able to do a cost check. And so the suggestion here is that if the employer does not provide that data, which is critical to the operation of the system, there is a problem. Obviously, we accept that this is something that we're going to have to work with employers, because they have enjoyed an unofficial dispensation of extension that they have taken for themselves for some years now, and we're going to have to normalize the situation. I would add that if you look at the international experience, 60 days to put in your reconciliation is not unreasonable experience. Interest for non-provisional taxpayers. At the moment, if you're not a provisional taxpayer and SARS owes you a refund, and we issue a year after you put your return, you don't get any interest. Equally, if you're short pay, we don't charge you any interest. Now, from both perspectives, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because you've had the use of money. So what we're suggesting is that there should be a date from which interest will be paid or charged. If you're in a situation where you have a tax liability, you will be in a position to make a voluntary payment so that you don't have to pay it. So looking at it from this perspective here, the 1st of October, if you have by the 30th of September determined that you have a debt owing to SARS, and you should be in a position to do it 7 months after year end. Hopefully you've done your tax return by that month. Even if it hasn't been assessed, you know that you have a debt to SARS, you can make a payment to SARS, in which case there will be no interest. On the other hand, if you think that SARS is a good source of credit and you prefer to borrow money from the South African government, well, then we will charge you interest from the 1st of October until such time as the assessment is made. Right. Year of assessment. This is a fairly technical one, but one of interest to corporate taxpayers. It happens that for practical reasons, companies may decide that although their year end is say the 30th of June, they are going to close their books on the last Saturday because they can do a stock count over the weekend perhaps, or it's just easier to do the closing of the books over the weekend, or something of that nature. Now, technically speaking, you can't do that. You have to close your books on the 30th of June. That's how they all read. And what we're saying here is, we are prepared to permit a consistent window period of 10 days around the year. So if you want to do this for the last Saturday of the month, something of that nature, as long as you apply consistently and get the charges consent to do so, you can do that. Because it's simply more practical for everyone concerned. I think this is now the last slide, and this deals with payments of tax and interest. At the moment, when you have put in an objection or an appeal, you can ask for not to recover the money because you have a dispute as to whether, in fact, the assessment is correct. So perhaps we have said something taxable, you think it is not. SARS looks at that, says, okay, you don't look like a flight risk, it seems like you have a reasonable case of this privilege. We look at several factors, we say, fine, you can have an extension to pay. Because that, the idea being that if the dispute is resolved in the interim, there is a reasonable chance that you're not going to have to pay at all. Now, some taxpayers have attempted to take the wording of this particular provision and say, well, that extension of payment becomes something that suspends the interest charge whilst we wait. And that is, again, not what you're looking at. Again, you have the use of the money, it does not pay over to SARS, so interest charge should run, and you're simply making slight adjustments to the legislation to ensure that this rather technical argument as to why you do not have to pay interest for this period of extension is removed, and that we do not have to agree with you. Sure, I think that's it from our side. I'm sure there are several questions waiting there for us. Several comments tomorrow that will tell us.
Gary Abbott, member. Claudio, Murray.
Thank you, Chair. Just from
the screen, I'm just going to make sure I've got all the just the judge.
Mr. Chair, just three very brief and small questions. Starting on the last slide, is that applicable interest? Has that been defined as 18%, 15.5%, or how do you work on that one? Then, on the slide 5, which deals with home associations, if a share block is a sell the assets of, says our old share block, and that gets divided among the obviously shareholders. Will that be dealt with the same as that proposal of the Department of Investment Income, or is it differently? And then the last one, which is very quickly, that's just about 2010 World Cup. Why does that apply only to 2010 and not to similar events? I don't think that has been applicable in the past. And so I just wanted to know that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you
so
much.
I have one question. I would want Keith to take us through this slide 23, 24, 25, 26 slowly. The challenge that I'm facing is that in your argument you're saying the issue of tax-free repatriation back to South Africa are used to undermine headquarters. Can you explain that, how that process takes place? And you go further to say, to propose, I'm not sure whether this is your proposal, on slide 26, on what to tax. You say level one, one tax gain on headquarters control shares, and two net market value on deemed disposition of assets.
Is it possible that you to explain to me how this process takes place of undermining the headquarters
and how those foreign subsidiaries are being unbundled in South Africa.
Thank you very much, Chair. Slide 32, the foreign expats accommodation. Now, you refer there to a case in court. Can we just briefly be told, you know, what was the outcome of the case? Because assuming modification, your exemption period is extended to 2 years. Now, isn't this going to go against what the court has probably ruled? Then on slide 39, your PBOs, and you can claim, you know, tax on that. Is a church the PBO? Or does it have to register as PBO? And then the last question is on slide 43. I think many people welcome e-filing, things like that. But the requirement to keep your documents for 5 years, now you're passing the onus on to the taxpayer. And sometimes that is considered a bit unreasonable for somebody who moves house or house gets burned or something like that to keep these documents for 5 years. And related to that, for the PAYE-IRP5 recalls, would there be a window period to allow for companies to adjust their systems maybe for next year so that they can comply with the 60 days? Thank you.
Dr. Charles?
Thank you, Chair. Just one question for clarity. On slide number 17, it's mentioned that intra-group relief has been used to promote leverage buy-up acquisition. How widespread would you say that this is? Thank you.
All right, so just working through the questions, what interest is paid or charged? The interest that is paid or charged here links to the Public Finance and Management Act. At present, it is we charge 14% and we pay 10%. On the home associations, the idea here is that the home association is acting for its members. Okay. So if the home association, for example, if it had a vacant piece of land next to the unit, sold off that vacant land, as it would be if the members owned that piece of land as a partnership. So the idea is not to place the home association in a better position. The reason we're doing this with interest is primarily as a matter of convenience for both the home association and the SAR. Because at the moment, if there is interest income, it's going to have to register the provisional tax and provisional tax return. And do we really want to do that for half a thousand or 2,000 rands worth of interest on a small court account? There may very well be a wealthy home association that earns 100,000, 500,000 rands worth of interest on a very large court account. Well, there, if the members receive that interest individually, they would be taxed on it. Equally, they should be taxed on it if they do it by way of the general association. On the 2010 World Cup, why is this event? Essentially, all bidders for the 2010 World Cup had to commit to certain tax concessions. And if you wanted to be in the race, you had to put those tax concessions on the table. FIFA is in a very strong position when it comes to convicts to host the World Cup, and so we wanted to host this, we put those concessions on the table. On slide 32, the Expatria and the court case, essentially, just to rewind a little on this one, SARS has always taken the position that if you have a foreign expatriate come into the country, they could stay in the country for up to a year without triggering a fringe benefit. That was a practice that SARS had developed. A number of taxpayers decided that they did not agree with that practice on a strict interpretation of the law. And in this particular case, although the employer withheld the tax, the employee proceeded to court to say, I actually did not have to pay the tax on a strict interpretation of the law.
And the learned judge said, on the reading of the law, he agreed. They did not have to pay the tax. Although you can see the rationale for what Stars is trying to achieve, the law does not support it. And if Stars wanted to do what it is trying to achieve, it would have to approach Parliament for a legislative intervention, which we did last year. And so we started out with proposing a 6-month period, which would have been aligned with some of the periods used in our international treaties. And in the end, we moved to the year effect just sustaining the original practice. This year, we are in fact being more generous than the original practice in one respect, which is making it 2 years, and we are pulling back in another respect in that we are placing a cap on the maximum amount that is available per month. On the questions of churches being CEOs, churches very often are CEOs. But that doesn't mean that a donation to a church is deductible. It would only be deductible if the church is conducting a specific class of public benefit activity and has been approved by God in that respect. So for example, it's assisting in treatment of HIV, the care of patients, of AIDS orphans, and there are a number of public benefit activities that qualify for tax deductible. So it would then ring-fence those activities, and if the donation is made specifically for those activities, then it would be on the question of retaining documents for 5 years, that is the general rule for retaining supporting documents across the income tax. And I accept that some people may use documents in a file, although I must admit it does seem to raise an assessor's eyebrows a little when he hears it's been lost in a fire or she hears that it's been flooded away. But obviously there are legitimate cases where that does occur and we have to take that into account. On the window period for the adjustment of system, some employers manage it. But again, as I say, we accept that people have gotten used to perhaps a less robust enforcement of this particular rule than it was warranted. And so that is precisely why this year we will be working with employers, payroll workers, to try and see how we can get people onto the system so that going forward we get the information within the kind of time frame that will make it useful for you. We have some innovative thoughts about how to achieve it, but just make sure they work before we are.
Getting back to the issue group stuff, this first one is a question, a couple of comments. Again, issue group is designed to give access to the group, but in a lot of merger and acquisition deals, it's really being designed to facilitate leverage buyouts at various times. Now, when we talk about mergers and acquisitions, most of the time the buyer doesn't have cash, so they need to borrow money. So my understanding is as of late, necessarily as of late, that the use of intergroup for merger and acquisition activity is very, very common. It outweighs by far the original intention. So if you take it on a life of its own, again, that may be acceptable, consider that. But again, if it is going to be used in that way, we want to limit the rollover of the referral, not for the rejection. So that's the second issue. Now, again, on my redomicile issue, I apologize for trying to move quickly on this thing, maybe a little too fast. So we turn over to slide 23 and slide 24, kind of slide 23. There are really two sets of basic rules that can be in this slide. If you distribute dividends in cash back to the HQ company, that was the main intent. That's fine, that rule works. The dividend rule is not because it's in trouble. The second rule is where we've gotten in trouble, and that is that if the South African company sells a foreign subsidiary, what we want it to happen is one of two things. One was if they sold it for cash, the HQ parent would get the cash and give it back. That's the rule. Or, alternatively, the South African parent could restructure the move one to like simply have 5 or 10 subsidiaries under there and you start moving them around, people say that's fine. But you turn it over to the next slide is where the avoidance occurs. And that is what happens is the South African parent doesn't sell or dispose of the foreign subsidiary for cash. So whatever it's got rid of, there is no cash flow that comes in. So if the foreign subsidiary was 100 million, we want 100 million cash coming back to the HQ. In the first example, is an unbundle. If you unbundle, technically the legislation in prior years applies, so you can unbundle the foreign subsidiary, the HQ parent would get nothing in return, and the South African shareholders would directly own the foreign subsidiary. And that foreign subsidiary would become the new HQ. That is, you know, avoidance number one. Now, there are other ways to do it, and that's what the legislation is hinting at. Let us say South African parent sells for 1 rand, or if South African parent enters into a series of liquidations beforehand. There are problems if there are the foreign subsidiary liquidates its way in, or if the foreign subsidiary moves its interest onshore by moving the headquarters onshore, and then liquidates. But what effectively the main issue is disposing of the foreign subsidiary without the HQ getting the cash back in. There are many ways, longer ways of doing it. We've got the short way, it's the longer way.
Okay. Are there further questions? Mr. Block. Yeah, just to follow up on that, but then what are you proposing? Are you proposing this level 1 and 2? Referring me to the slide 26 in order to remedy the problem that you're addressing.
What we're trying to do in that one is have balance and pressure. What we're really going after there, I'm sorry, level 1 is what we're talking about. Level 2 is raised suggestions. Theoretically, when you leave our jurisdiction, there's 2 levels of corporate tax. One is the capital gain charge. The second one is the new dividend charge. We're not talking about level 2. At the moment, we're limiting it to level 1. There is a question about level 2, whether indeed we should have a special level 2. That is not an appropriate question. That could be another discussion. Level 1 is trying to make sure that you have that gain when that foreign subsidiary leaves our jurisdiction if we do not get the substitute cash or consideration in exchange for the HQ. This is about level 1.
Thank you. That then brings us to the end of the session. We will be having hearing tomorrow where we will take submissions from a number of affected parties. We have circulated a draft program for tomorrow, and also have put down those that have sent written submissions that are not going to be appearing. We also circulated this written submissions to members that just want to encourage members to read those submissions so that when they appear before us, members are ready with their questions or clarity, or that members are here on members so that they don't need to have questions of clarity. We meet tomorrow again. The venue tomorrow is Z227. Very unfriendly venue, but we don't decide where we meet. So we're meeting at Z227 tomorrow at 9:30. That brings us to the end of the session. The meeting is adjourned. Thanks.